Okay. All right. So I want to introduce to you all Lindsay McIntosh. Lindsay is working with NACDD and myself to bring this webinar series to you all. Lindsay is from the Consortium for Older Adult Wellness in Colorado. She has been trained to be a chronic disease self-management program leader, and she was trained in 2008. She joined the consortium staff later that year. Currently, Lindsay supervises implementation of multiple evidence-based programs throughout Colorado, including integration of falls prevention and self-management classes into health systems, community health centers, and individual practices seeking national recognition as patient-centered medical homes. She is the new Colorado statewide CDSMP Collaborative's chair. She is also a part of the Consortium for Older Adult Wellness team working with the Maryland Department of Aging's Living Well grant and a member of the National Self-Management Alliance Goal Number 2 Work Group and Self-Management Learning Network. So please welcome Lindsay, who has a wealth of knowledge, and I'm so happy that she's able to share that with us over the course of the next 3 months. Lindsay?
Thank you, Mary. I appreciate that. I forgot to unmute myself. So I'm very happy to be here with all of you, and I want to say thank you to Mary for putting this all together, and also I have great appreciation for the group that worked with us on preparing this webinar series, including Mary and including Karen McCloskey from Michigan, as well as Erica Odom, Teresa Brady, and Angela Oliver, all from Centers for Disease Control. And so thank you all. And I know we have a lot to do today, and I mainly want to just have you take a look at the title for what we're going to be doing for the next three webinars. And please know that what this is about building connections and then looking at implementing after the connections are built and then looking at how do we scale them and how do we sustain them. So we have a lot to do, and so we're going to get going. So what I would like to do first of all is encourage you all to let me know either through questions during the webinar or through emails after the webinar what we can do to make this work for you and work better for you. So we are very open to your questions and comments. And I really appreciate the fact so many of you took the time to do the pre-webinar survey. It was greatly appreciated. So we want to start with what our webinar series learning objectives are. We have these four biggies for our three-part series. First is to really define the role of a state health department in terms of brokering a connection between healthcare systems and community-based organizations implementing programs. And I know about 60% of you on the call are from state organizations, state health departments. The other pieces we want to do are to establish a greater number of partnerships. And I know on the line today we have hospital systems, provider organizations, physician organizations, as well as university representatives, community-based organizations, and technical assistance organizations. So this is how we begin. Next thing we want to do is increase reach through these partnerships that we are working on, and then we want to create a plan for your state health department to embed, scale, and sustain referrals and the ongoing connection between community-based programs and health practices and centers. We also want to talk about the barriers in terms of making this plan. And that can include some of the things that we won't be necessarily addressing today, but will be addressing in our December call and our January call, including some of the actual process questions. How do you get referral systems to work? What's the difference between a recommendation and a referral? Setting up feedback systems for the practice and the community-based organization, really assessing partnerships, assessing whether where you are not only in terms of your own readiness, but in terms of your partner's readiness as well. And then I also want to talk about the two biggies that came up again and again in the survey we did and have come up with every clinic we've ever talked with or every community-based organization. And the two biggies are time and money. So how do we do all of that at once and Today we're going to start with how do we begin making sense of healthcare transformation. So here are our objectives for our very first work together. Over 60% of you indicated that you have had some experience working with the connection between healthcare and community-based organizations. And so what we want to do is review kind of the overview of national statistics, healthcare changes, opportunities, so that we're all on the same page. Then we're going to go through some definitions of what these terms mean for us in lieu of our work together. And then we're going to talk about building on what it is that exists now for you and how to expand that. And keep in mind, if you will, that this is part one of three. So we may not have time to get to everything today in terms of how all of these systems work, what all of the details are, and life, the universe, and everything. But hopefully, by the end of the third webinar, we'll have it all. Some national statistics for you. These should be no surprises to most of you. These come from the Center for Disease Control. The big one is that just amazes me every time I see it. 67 million, that's 25% of adults over 18, have doctor-diagnosed arthritis by the year 2030. That's just staggering to me. In addition to that, 7 out of 10 deaths are from chronic disease. 1 out of every 2 adults has a chronic illness. 22% of adults have reported doctor-diagnosed arthritis, and then 66% of adults with arthritis are overweight or obese. Number one cause of disability is arthritis, and diabetes continues to be the leading cause of kidney failure, non-traumatic lower extremity amputations, and blindness for people between the ages of 20 and 74. That is huge. So we know that there are problems. We also know that, and thanks to the National Council on Aging for a couple of these slides, we also know that our population is aging. And especially this is true in the oldest of the old, those who are 85 years and better. And the statistic that is amazing to me is that there are 5.7 million in this age group in 2010, and by 2050, there will be 19 million. So not only are we increasing the percentage of people with chronic conditions as they age, we are also increasing the population of our aging Americans. So here we are. This, again, is from the National Council on Aging. Just in terms of the epidemic of chronic conditions, what this indicates is that 90.7%, okay, we'll call it 91%, of those over 65 have one chronic condition. 73% have two or more. And key risks for chronic conditions, as you'll see from the slide, 70% of the risks are behavioral and environmental factors. Smoking, diet, nutrition, physical inactivity, falls, alcohol, substance abuse, stress, and social isolation. 70%. So we know that 75% of every dollar spent now on healthcare goes toward highly controllable, manageable, preventable chronic diseases. World Health Organization, Center for Disease Control and Prevention have estimated that 80% of heart disease and type 2 diabetes can be prevented by doing three things. And you know what these are: exercise more, eat better, avoid alcohol. So clearly we know change is needed. We also know that in the cosmic scheme of things, we spend a lot less time with our healthcare providers than we do with ourselves, with our families. And we also know that as individuals, we need to change. So how are we going to do that? Well, the Center for Disease Control has four domains, as you know. Epidemiology and surveillance is domain one. Environmental approach is number two. Number three is healthcare systems, interventions. And domain number four is strategies to improve community clinical linkages, ensuring that community support and clinics refer patients to programs that improve management of chronic conditions. That would be what we're here to talk about. So this includes folks with arthritis, diabetes, any kind of chronic disease. It includes chronic condition self-management, including physical activity programs and community settings, such as work sites, the Y's, rec centers, senior community centers, and other local organizations. And to really increase the use of Center for Disease Control approved evidence-based lifestyle change programs, for example, a diabetes prevention program. So where did we start with all this? It all started with the chronic care model, Ed Wagner's wonderful vision of what this could all look like and how we could all work together a little better to improve everyone's health. And there are several different iterations now of the chronic care model, but what the beginning piece was that community and health systems work together to provide assistance so that an activated patient in conjunction with a very productive medical team could together improve outcomes, and outcomes not just in terms of how the patient feels, but outcomes in terms of cost reduction, outcomes in terms of better public health as well as individual health. So that's where it all started. And so we have the four domains. We have also the chronic care model. And we know that programs like diabetes prevention program, chronic disease self-management program, the arthritis-related exercise and falls prevention programs all exist in order to meet the needs of the public. And to implement systems to increase the number of provider referrals to these programs is the goal of one of the goals of the CDC work. So, in addition to the CDC domains, we also know that CMS, Center for Medicaid and Medicare, has a triple goal. Number one is better care, improving the experience of health care, better health, which means improving population health, and then lowering costs, which means reducing health care costs for all of us. So we know those are all in play. They all realize that change is needed, and they all realize that patient involvement is at the heart of it. So that's great. we get that. And so now what do we do about that? So we know that ultimately we're looking at the patient as being the person who's responsible for making the changes. And that's wonderful. I sometimes wonder, though, if we have actually shared that news with the patient. And so the changes that are coming in healthcare transformation all are about the individual taking responsibility and the individual making changes. So ultimately, the individual is responsible. Self-management, defined here by the Institute of Medicine, is the task that individuals must undertake to live well with one or more chronic conditions. For our purposes, self-management is what I do or what I don't do when I'm with my healthcare provider. I rewrote this a little bit because when we work with the clinics, we wanted something that was very much a one-sentence version of what's the difference between self-management, medical management, and self-management support. So self-management is what I do, what I don't do, when I'm not with my healthcare provider. That's what I drink, what I eat, what I don't drink, what I don't eat. It includes what I smoke or don't smoke, how I move, how I don't move, how I think, all of those things, how much sleep I get, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's all the choices that I make when on my own. Self-management is what I do. And again, the success of the transformation in healthcare is based in large part on me making those changes, me making choices that are better. So how do we get me to do a little bit better job of that? This is one of my very favorite slides. Community resources are absolutely wonderful. They are what I do every day, and I love it, and I have a great passion for it. Community resources and connecting community resources to health providers is wonderful. Better medications, better ways of dealing with pain management, absolutely wonderful and terrific. Being able to measure on a day-to-day basis someone's glucose level, their A1C, is fantastic. But engaging the person is the only way to successfully impact those clinical outcomes as opposed to the process measures. You can take my A1C level every day from here until the end of time, but unless I eat something differently or drink something differently or move differently, unless I as an individual do something differently, those markers will not change. And it's the clinical outcomes and it's my success as a patient is the heart of healthcare transformation. So it's about each of us as individuals making changes and choices that then ultimately affect the whole. So if you agree with me that engaging the patient is important and that on those that engagement rests much of healthcare transformation, the question then becomes, okay, how do we make that happen? How do we move that? So self-management support, this is the top one is the definition from the Centers for Disease Control. And the bottom is, for our purposes today, self-management support is how a practice, how a health system, and how a state health department acting as a broker in this relationship, or a bridge, if you will, in this relationship, how those entities can support me as an individual in making better choices. We're going to talk more about this as we go through today as well as our other times together. But self-management support is really about what is involved, all the pieces and parts, to support me in making one little change successfully. So that includes things like perhaps a treatment goal, a self-management goal, for a practice to be able to assess barriers, for a community-based organization to be able to look at the barriers they're setting up to keep people out of classes unintentionally. But if you only have classes during the day and you're reaching out to people who work all day and only can come to classes in the evening, you've created another barrier. It's about educational resources. It's about self-management tools. And that can be things like an exercise log, a list of exercises, a blood pressure log, counseling to adopt healthy behaviors. All of these are self-management support. Tracking referrals to community resources, that too is self-management support. Providing educational resources, using your electronic medical records to make the most of what you have available for a patient with a given diagnosis. All of these fall under the self-management support umbrella. So we also need to talk about what is self-management education. Again, we have the Centers for Disease Control definition. For our purposes today, though, self-management education is an evidence-based approach to the skill set of managing conditions and making choices. So it's self-management education is evidence-based by definition. And what's an evidence-based program? Now, 90% of you said that you were very comfortable discussing evidence-based programs with healthcare providers. And that's fantastic. And I believe you, because if you are involved with evidence-based programs, you understand how well they work. And you understand that the light bulbs come on over people's heads when they are involved in evidence-based programs. And those of us who've had the experience of co-leading classes or of being involved in any way recognize how important these programs are. The key is, can you talk about evidence-based programs in a way that allows who you're talking to understand how it benefits them? Specifically, if you are excited about evidence-based programs and talking to a health system, can you explain it in a way that will engage them and help them understand why they want to be referred as a health system or a practice? Or why they want to be engaged, I should say, rather than referred. Why they want to be engaged in your evidence-based programs. It's more than just saying we have great classes. And I know you all know that, but we're going to get really specific about how we do that. So an evidence-based program, for our purposes and definition, it's one that's been effective and it's been rigorously evaluated statistically. For example, a program like the Chronic Disease Self-Management Program was written initially and researched by Dr. Kate Lorig at Stanford. Then the program went and was evaluated by federal grants from the National Institutes on Health, U.S. Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, and then the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Then it's an evidence-based program. So self-management skills come in all different variations of programs and all different variations of evidence-based programs. Self-management skills are not a one-size-fits-all proposition. One program does not work equally well for everybody. An exercise program that emphasizes developing and attaining small goals in movement and in change is also addressing self-management skills. Remember that the definition of self-management is the task that individuals must undertake to live well with one or more chronic condition. So an exercise program that supports that skill building is also an evidence-based self-management program. Now, I want to talk just a little bit about embedding or community-based programs. And then we'll take a break and see if anybody has questions. An embedded program, for our definition, means one that lives within and is offered within a healthcare system or a practice. A community-based program is one that is offered within a community center. That could be a AAA, an area agency on aging. That could be a rec center. That could be the local Y. That could be a faith community. That could be the agency's office. Embedded refers to within the health system for our definitions. Both of these are very much wins, and both of these involve making the connection between a community-based organization and a health system. Because even if you are embedding something within a health system, the community-based organization is still involved in helping to establish that. They're still involved in being there to advise, perhaps to provide training, to perhaps to support scaling the program. It does not have to be an either-or. It can be a hybrid. You can start out with working with a health system where you are doing community-based classes and eventually embed the program. There are many different models for how this can work. So it isn't necessarily one over the other. Both of them are wins in different ways. If you're a practice, why would you want to go to a community-based organization for evidence-based programs? That's a really valid question. If you're a practice, why would you want to even deal with this? And let me answer that real quickly. We'll come back to it, but here's my very quick reference sheet I use for why you would want to do that. If you're a practice and you go to a community-based organization for classes and access to classes, you're using an external resource. You're not using your own practice resources. There's absolutely no need to recreate the wheel. It already exists in its entirety with fidelity within your community. If you're working with a community-based organization, they can help and assist you with reinforcing communication. They can provide information back to you. We call that the feedback loop, and we'll talk more about that later. A community-based organization can also document self-management referrals in a way that are consistent with patient-centered medical home terminology. It can also shift the way patients communicate by working with a community-based organization, by needing to come back to the practice and talk about what they're learning. But it also can document the shift in patient interactions. It can also, the community-based organization can also help document the effectiveness of what's happening in terms of quality measures, in terms of data back to the practice. So increased activation, increased patient engagement, increased patient confidence level, and ease of access. That's why if you're a practice or a health system, you want to be working with community-based organizations. So if you're a community-based program, why would you want to work with healthcare practices and systems? Well, when we started doing this work back in 2008, it was because that was where people who needed the classes were. If you are someone who has multiple chronic conditions, you may not be going to a rec center. You may not be going to much of any place except perhaps your doctor's office. But we knew that even people with multiple chronic conditions were still getting out, as socially isolated as they were becoming. We knew they were still interacting with their healthcare system. And so that's where we wanted to go, because we knew then we would meet the people who could really use an intervention like this. And then if you're a state health department, why would you want to connect this clinical to the community? And I think the reason you want to be the bridge is that this is the way you reach people. This is the way that you help people individually make the connections that then make the big changes happen on across the board. And that's what everybody is gearing toward. So before we go on, I am looking to see if there are any questions. And I'm not seeing any yet. Does anybody have anything before we move on? Okie dokie. So we are going to talk about, I promise you, you don't have to read the whole Affordable Care Act. That's not going to be your homework. That would be very cruel and mean. But what we're going to do is we're going to talk about the Affordable Care Act as really an opportunity to increase access to health care with the intention of expanding prevention, expanding wellness, and expanding access to services. So when we talk about the Affordable Care Act, we're talking about it from that point of view. And we aren't going to spend a lot of time on it today. In fact, that's all we're going to talk about it today. But we will address that a little bit more later. I wanted to talk about, what is a patient-centered medical home? What is this whole concept in healthcare transformation? Because this is something we're going to come back to again and again and again. What we have here is the definition of what a PCMH is. And the bottom line on what is a patient-centered medical home is that it is team-based, it's primary care, and most of all, the patient is the center of it. And it's amazing how often that message, even within healthcare transformation, still gets lost, that this is about the patient and about things getting better for the patient. About 22% of you said that you were really comfortable with what was in a patient-centered medical home and what is not in a patient-centered medical home. So we're going to spend a little bit more time on that. How does a patient-centered medical home work? It's very much a team-based approach. It's very much the team can change. The team always involves the patient. But it can also involve a pharmacist, support staff, a physician. It can include outside specialists. It can include community-based organizations. It can include anything or anyone that supports the patient, and that team-based approach can change. The team itself can change. The approach does not change. Sorry about that. So let me go through a couple of these. We've already talked about how important the patient is. The personal physician is also important. All patients have an ongoing relationship with a physician who is responsible for providing their acute, chronic, and continuous care. And so the relationship with the physician continues. It's also about the team continuing and evolving and including family and including the community. And then there's the big piece of care coordination. And we've all heard care transitions referenced many times and the move toward making those more cost-effective. And care coordination, care transitions are about reducing the wear and tear on the patient and also about saving financially. A large part of patient-centered care is ensuring that patients have the capacity, the resources, and the knowledge to do the work that they need to do in self-management. So if you give someone a tool, a resource, a medication, but you don't give them the other tools they need to manage their care, to understand how to take the medication, to understand the importance of what they eat and what they don't eat, then you're only getting halfway there. So a large part of what the whole transformation is about developing those outreach efforts, the collaborative treatment approach, and setting goals not only for behavioral health treatment goals, but behavioral health changes and health outcomes on the part of the patient and the clinic. So there is evidence that this works. There is work in terms of the continuity associated with reductions in mortality from patient-centered medical homes. There is also indications that patients with diabetes who make action plans had a reduction in A1Cs. The actual study said they went, if they were making a goal, their average A1C went from 8.9 to 8.0, as opposed to patients who received education in writing but did not do action plans, their A1C level stayed set at 8.7. And there is also a medical review for care gaps that, or a study that showed that when MAs, medical assistants, review for care gaps, meaning they're looking to see what's missing, it resulted in improvements in A1C levels being taken, LDL, smoking cessation, flu shots, well woman exam, PAPs, and mammograms. So all of these self-management support pieces have also been documented and show that they actually work in terms of cost savings. Okay, National Committee for Quality Assurance. I know some of you are familiar with this, and I want you to know that this is the way practices are able to document that they really have transformed, that they have become patient-centered medical homes, is through application and recognition through the National Committee for Quality Assurance. So when a practice or a health system is going through this, they will say they are working on their application, they're working on their transformation. But please know that the NCQA is not the only place where this work is happening. There are other organizations, other ways of assessing and recognizing the transformation. For example, the Joint Commission, people do the application through there as well. They also have ways within private pay to make similar sorts of transformation to show that it has happened and to document it. For example, the Patient-Centered Primary Care Home Incentive Program is out of, that's a long title, is out of the Blue Cross Blue Shield program in Michigan. And that is one that is based on and relates directly back to the NCQA recognition and standards, but is specific to Blue Cross Blue Shield. There are a number of other private pay programs like this that are about connecting increasing outcomes in terms of patient actions and how that then relates to return on investment for the payers, which then relates to increased reimbursements to the practice. So there are a number of different programs and studies and payers that are doing work similar to what is happening in Michigan. The programs are called different things. They all relate back to NCQA guidelines. So for the purposes of the call, just to give us a template to work with, we're going to talk about the NCQA guidelines. But just know that they are called different things in other places, and there are different pilots in many other states that are along similar guidelines. So the process for NCQA really involves a lot of work on patient satisfaction. Is the patient getting what they want from the practice? There's also a lot of attention to care coordination, behavioral health, and a huge emphasis on self-management. And this is very true on whether the NCQA certification is being done for a community health center, which is the work that we did with the Colorado Community Health Network in Colorado, or whether it's with a private practice. The focus on self-management is about improving clinical outcomes as well as behavioral health. But if you can have somebody support someone in doing a better job of medication management, you're also not only helping them feel like they have a more important role in their health care, but you may also be directly improving their outcomes. So the NCQA certification process, there are 6 standards, and we'll show you those in a minute. In those 6 standards, there are 6 what they call must-pass elements. These are things you have to be successful at and be able to document, or you do not become a patient-centered medical home. So of these 6 standards, the ones that are in red are the ones that directly relate to what we're talking about today with connecting community resources to health systems and self-management. These 3, population management, care management, active support, are really the heart of what happens within NCQA transformation, what happens within patient-centered medical home transformation. In particular, number 4, active support of patient self-management. Now, next time we talk, we will be getting into the very the details of why this is important and why that support of self-management is how you then connect a community-based organization to a healthcare system and why those two are geared around this standard number 4. Let me show it to you another way. If you look up where that nice little star is, you will see that that is standard number 4, provide self-care support and community resources. That is a tricky thing for a practice to do because we just spent a long time explaining what is self-management, what is self-management support. You already know what community resources are, but to explain that to a patient in a clinical setting or to a whole practice that's going through transformation is it takes a lot of time. And part of what they have to do to make this work is to support a patient's self-care process, to document not only treatment goals, but to document my self-management goals, my ability to make choices, and to refer me to community resources. That's a lot of work. And that's a lot of work for the practice that's all new and different from how they have operated in the past. And so what you can help connect if you are a state health department is to understand those pieces and moving parts and what role the community-based organization can play, what role the health system can play, and how you make those two connect. Here is just a little bit of what a practice is looking for. When they are reaching out toward a community-based organization, when they're sending patients your way as a community-based organization, when they're partnering with a state, what they're looking for are education resources for at least 50% of their patients. They're looking for a way to document self-management plans and goals with 50% of their patients. They're looking for a way to assess the ability and willingness to change of their patients. They're looking for self-management tools, and they're looking for ways to counsel their patients. And they're looking for a way to do that quickly because time and money is an issue for them as well as for everyone else, perhaps more so. And so we are able to help them realize that you can, as a community-based organization, meet some of these needs and problems, solve with them. And again, we'll be talking more about that. So what does this all mean? What this means is that the national data shows that standard 4, self-management, and also standard 3, but particularly standard 4 in self-management, is the most difficult one for community health centers and for practices to meet. And the reason for that is it involves changing how a staff works together, how a staff views the patient role and their care. It involves how much conversation takes place and the quality of conversation that takes place between a practice and a client. It involves how the staff works with each other, how they plan ahead for it. It involves how things are documented. It involves the messaging with the patient. It involves everything that's given to the patient. In other words, it covers workflow. It covers care teams, it covers documentation, and just so you know, once a practice becomes a patient-centered medical home, that it's just beginning. The work is just beginning. Then it becomes about doing more and better and adjusting things. So, why do all these standards matter to you at this point? You're probably thinking, I am not applying for NCQA. Why do I care? Well, here's why you care. It's about making connections in a meaningful way. So if you are a state and you want to be able to be the bridge between referrals and from a health system to a community-based organization about offering and being able to support community-based programming in your state, understanding how these connections work will be very important. The other piece is that understanding the connection helps to solidify the transformation and the pieces that all of the partners can play in it. And then there's also that little scalability. And when we're talking about scalability, we're not just talking about reach for your programs in your state. We're talking about financial sustainability as well. So we want to make sure that we're addressing all of your needs as a state, as well as the needs moving forward for the community-based organization and the health system. I like this slide because I feel like this some days. And as I'm watching the clock and seeing how much time we have left, I want to make sure we have some time to address questions. So what I would suggest is that we take a pause, we answer some questions before we move on, but also I just want to make note of the fact that one of the biggest gifts you can give to a community-based organization is reach. One of the biggest gifts you can give to a clinical practice is time. And for all of us, this takes time to develop that bridge and that relationship. It also takes training and it takes follow-up. And making these connections are definitely worth it, but definitely an investment in terms of time. So we'll get to that too. And I see that some questions came up, and I apologize, Mary, I haven't had a chance to read them. So is there somebody that wanted that had a question, or was there a comment?
Hey, Lindsay, this is Mary. There is a comment that somebody made that she said that certain clinics provide a great mechanism to connect with specific populations who may be otherwise hard to reach, like FQHCs and other safety net clinics can serve this purpose. But in this person's experience, they're more interested in embedded programs. So that was just a comment from one of the participants.
Ah, okay. Great. Thank you. Well, I think that the work that we've seen in Colorado with the federally qualified health centers is that it really depends very much on the clinic, whether they are looking for some programs to be embedded, for example, perhaps a diabetes education program, but then there are other programs that they may be interested in having not physically on site, but have something that is more of a referral basis, something that is off-site. We also will talk a little bit about this, but one of the things that we have discovered is in some communities, it's very helpful to have a class or a program offered on-site at a health center or a community health center because it eliminates barriers. The patients know how to go to the clinic. They know where to park. They know where the bus stops. They know how to walk in. They know they're welcome. And so in some cases, it's very helpful to have that program embedded within the practice. In other situations and in other communities, what we found is that just the opposite is true. People don't want to go to the health center or their practice because that's where they go when they're sick. And they're not sick, they're going to an exercise class. Or they're not sick, they're going to a chronic disease class. And so, or a chronic condition, or a diabetes prevention program. So in those situations, depending on what the clinic tells us about how their patients, how their community works, they have the best gut instincts on which will work best. And so sometimes we very intentionally will offer a class that is a program that's embedded in the clinic, but we actually host a class off-site so that although it's embedded in how the clinic's workflow exists and how the payment works, the class itself may be held off-site just because the patients feel more comfortable that way. So it really varies on a community-by-community basis as well as on a clinic-by-clinic basis. But I totally agree with the whole idea of specific populations and specific course titles that can work with different clinics within the Safety Net program and community health program. I am going to go ahead and move on here. I just wanted to give you a little overview then of what the pieces and parts are, just a little bit of an understanding of what the practice is looking for. So within what a clinic and a medical care facility are looking for, they're going to be coming up with a care plan for patients. There's a care plan that's basically the clinical view of things, and then there's a care plan for the patient. And a care plan may include a treatment goal, like we are going to lower your A1C. We're going to increase your mobility and lower your pain level. There may be referrals or recommendations made, including we want you to see this specialist, we want you to go here for physical therapy, and we want you to attend this exercise program sponsored by the Arthritis Foundation, and we want you to enroll in this self-management skill-building program. Also included in that care plan will be the responsibilities of the patient. We want you to take this medication. Here's how we want you to take this medication. So a treatment goal is actually the outcome of the medical intervention. The self-management goal, which is the second one on this list, is really what I as a patient am willing to do. And the strength of reach, the amount of reach your program can have, is directly related to connecting to what the clinic needs as well as what the patient needs. So understanding not only the self-management goal that the patient needs to have in place and that the practice needs to document, but the real strength of this is the connection between what your programs can offer, what your state can broker, and what the health system needs. That's where the real strength comes in. So we're talking about building a strong bridge, not just a little flimsy bridge. The fourth bullet here is about referrals, and we're going to talk a lot about what is a referral and what is a recommendation, and we're going to talk about the difference, and we're going to talk about how they get documented and the importance of both. I want to say just a couple of things about what the NCQA guidelines say, what the Affordable Care Act guidelines say about community-based programs, and what they don't say. And I think this is important because there's some wiggle room in here, and it's within this wiggle room, that's a technical term, but within this opening is where we have the ability to really make the connection and start building the bridge. So bear with me as I walk through this with you. So partnerships supporting the connection from community-based organizations to healthcare. They help with the benefit of the state make a strong bridge. We've talked about that. So we're working at the bridge between a community-based organization and a healthcare organization, making it good and strong for the benefit of the patient. So the NCQA guidelines talk about supporting the self-care process. They talk about the fact that a provider, a healthcare provider, needs to give education resources, needs to develop and document self-management plans and goals with 50% of their patients, needs to document the ability to self-manage, needs to provide self-management tools. That would be something like a food journal, an exercise journal. Needs to be able to counsel patients and families to adopt healthy behaviors. The community resources piece within NCQA refers to supporting patients and families in accessing community resources. So that includes maintaining a current resource list of 5 topics or key community service agencies or resources that can be helpful to the practice and to the patient. Now, those are that would be also a recommendation area. Here are some programs you might want to take a look at. Here's how you access the quit line. Here's the local food bank. All of those are resource lists that may be appropriate for that given practice and may include community-based opportunities. But also involved in this is the tracking of referrals for patients and their families. So the ability to document, not only do we recommend you go here, but we are going to refer you for services here. And then also providing treatment for mental health, substance abuse disorders, opportunities for health education, peer support. But the MCQA guidelines do not specify an evidence-based program, any one in particular or one over another. So if you are a practice and you are Dr. Bob, you can write a program that says, hi, I'm Dr. Bob, this is my Happy Healthy Patient program. And you can use that program that you write yourself as a way to meet the MCQA guidelines. And you would need to properly document it. There are some rules around that. However, Dr. Bob's Happy Healthy Patient program takes a lot of time for you to develop. And since it's not evidence-based, it's never going to be on the CDC list of approved programs. It's not going to be on the NCOA list. And it will never be reimbursable, whether by a private insurer or payer or whether by Medicare or Medicaid, because it doesn't have the background, it doesn't have the support nationally, and it is not evidence-based. So although if you are Dr. Bob, you may think this gets me a way to get one step closer and faster to my NCQA recognition, it does not help you in the long run. In the long run, what is helpful is to connect to a community-based program where you're not recreating the wheel, where you don't have to do it yourself. It's already done, and it helps you align with supporting, sustaining, embedding your program in the long run. So you can make the case to a health system or a provider that the best way, the best approach to meeting those transformation requirements, the best way to align with payment pilots toward reimbursement, the best way to align with the Affordable Care Act, and the best way to provide accessibility to quality programs is by working with partnerships that are supporting the connection to community-based organizations. So we're going to be using this case, we're going to be using that rationale as how we make our further points and work toward really building this bridge in a very solid way. What we will be covering in the next couple of sessions, it will be including the details of the process in terms of communication within a practice, within a community-based organization. We're going to talk about expectations and the role of the state in helping to manage those expectations. We're going to talk about workflow practices in terms of the practice workflow, the community-based organization workflow, and how sometimes best case scenario works, sometimes best case scenario does not work, and we have some lessons learned on that. We're going to talk about messaging within the practice, the specifics of how to make a referral, the specifics of what a recommendation is and how that works. We're going to talk about communication with partners, and that's my homework, is to get that ready for us. In the meantime, I want to talk a little bit about what your homework is, and then hopefully we'll have some more questions, or at least one more question. What I would like to do is talk with you just a little bit first about what our emphasis again today was on, trying to make sense of all these pieces and moving parts, big picture things in terms of healthcare, with the goal being how do we implement programs in health centers, and how does the state help broker those relationships and increase reach? So that's what we've been working on today, and our next webinar is going to be connecting programs specifically with what the practice needs and support of the patient, and specifically what does the community-based organization need to make this work. So we're going to talk in more detail about not only the NCQA process, but documenting it and documenting the role of the community-based organization as well as what the state entity can do. So your homework is we'd really like you to take some time with your partners on the call and think about what bridges already exist in your state between health systems and evidence-based programs. You may be one of those fortunate states that has it hardwired and is ready to go and everything's perfect. You may be one that has some funding in place now, so your state employees are able to access some evidence-based programs at no cost to them. Are you already scaling up so your delivery systems can accommodate the increase in Medicaid clients? Are you doing care transition coaching? Do you have a process in place for that? So really to look at what you have in place now that you can expand upon. The next piece of this is what additional connections or bridges would you like to see in place? So if you already have a bridge and you want to put a second lane on that bridge or a third or a fourth, that would be the time to be thinking about that. If it's a matter of strengthening what you're doing, some of you said what you really wanted to see was specifics in terms of process, and that will be next webinar. We will definitely do that. So what additional connections or bridges would you like to see in place? And then especially for our friends, our state partners on board, what would you see as your role in making these connections and bridges successful? What support do you need? What additional partnerships would you like to see in place to make this work for you? And what can you explore or pursue between now and December 3rd? Because we would really like to see you take one of these things and work it like those of us trained in the chronic disease self-management program do. What is it you would really like to do between now and December 3rd? What one thing can you really say that you would like to work on? And is it achievable? And how are you going to do it? And what step can you get done? And how confident are you on a scale of 1 to 10? I know you guys all know this. But what I would really like to hear back from before our December 3rd call is not only what your plan was, but what activity you had and what you would like to see in terms of additional bridges, additional connections, strengthening of what you already have in place. So that would be the homework. That's not too tough. It's better than having to read all of the rules and regulations, you must say. So as we are getting ready to close, I wanted to make sure you had my information and make sure that you had Mary's information so that if you want to send us your homework, I would appreciate it. And what I really want to do now is open it up for questions and comments.
Lindsay, it's Mary. I do have a very basic question. As I listen to you talk about what's involved in becoming a patient-centered medical home, the question came to my mind that was, why would practices want to do it? And I think I know the answer, but I just wanted to ask out loud.
Well, you know, I've heard some practices say they've asked exactly that question. Why did I sign on to do this on purpose? But the truth of the matter is that with the changes in healthcare, as referenced in places like the Affordable Care Act and in the new payment plans that many of the health insurers are working with and toward, the ideas behind patient-centered medical home transformation, that's the alignment that's going to happen, so that a practice is going to have to show that their outcomes are improving. They're going to have to show that they are doing a better job of care transitions. They're going to have to show that readmissions are lower. So So all of those things are operating on a national level with a bit of a carrot and a stick, if you will. The carrot being many of the pilot programs and some of the smaller programs that have been put in place, not on a national level yet, but there are many programs where there is an increased reimbursement to the practice if they meet certain criteria. And those criteria are in line with patient-centered medical home recognition. So it depends a little bit on what the pilot is, what the plan is, what the payer is, but all of them are using those same kinds of measurements that align with becoming a patient-centered medical home in order to increase the revenue to the practice. So that would be the carrot. The stick would be that if you are not a practice that is transforming, that is making changes so that you are able to document what you are doing and how you are working with specialists and how you are treating patients and your patient satisfaction, you will quickly find in the next few years that you are no longer able to practice because there will be fines for not doing a good job. There will be a lower reimbursement to the practice for not doing a good job, for not meeting measurements, for not being patient-centered. And so what practices that we first talked with in, say, 2008, who said to us, well, we'll do this when there's money involved, but we're not going through all this now, are now coming back and saying, okay, now's the time. Now we're ready to do this work. And so that is that's a bit of the carrot and the stick coming together. So I would say right now it's about the alignment, Mary, more than anything, is that they realize that if they don't make these shifts, they don't align with the changes that are happening on a national basis and the changes in funding, that they will cease to exist.
Okay. Thanks. And we have a question in the chat.
Yay.
The question is, do you have experience with getting PCMH practices to share the costs for implementing the evidence-based programs?
Yes. And I will tell you that, and I think one of the things we're going to share in webinar two or three is I have some wonderful little videos that are about the practices talking about exactly this and what they've seen out of it. What we have seen is a real hybrid version of this for not only the community health centers, the federally qualified health centers, but private practices as well, in that initially how we have supported them is that frequently we grant dollars or we do some sort of pilot project with them or we do a demonstration project to show them the benefits of doing this kind of connect the dots between what they need and what a community-based organization does. So we show that initially, and we help them with the referral process and embedding the practice. Then what we see happening, and we have quite a few cases of this, the practice then sees the wisdom in training their own internal staff to carry on the program. And so then what happens is they either absorb the cost of training and sustaining the program internally, or we're able to help them in tandem so that they're providing a leader on staff, the community-based organization is providing a leader on staff, they're sharing the costs of materials, and they're doing it that way. So that works very well, especially in a smaller practice or within a smaller community. As you know, part of the trick within any community-based organization is if you have someone who is trained to deliver programs and then they leave. And that's exactly the same thing we've seen in the health systems as well, is that if it's a practice and they have a couple of people on staff trained and then they move them into other positions or they leave the practice. So even with an embedded system, keeping the relationship with a community-based organization is really crucial for sustaining the program and for being able to not do one class a year, but do three classes a year. And that would be scaling.
Great. Thank you. All right. So we have some folks with their hands raised. I'll go to Jackie Tompkins. Jackie, do you have a comment or a question?
Oh, sorry. No, I did not mean to click the button.
Okay, no problem, Jackie. Sorry.
So it's just like in a regular classroom, huh, when you just were stretching and they call on you. Sorry about that.
All right, well, we have another question in the chat. Someone says that they still have practices that seem to be interested only in HEDIS measures, and because CDSMP studies don't look at HEDIS measures, they're having a difficult time getting them to implement the program, even though they see that it might be beneficial. We explained all the things that you mentioned. Any suggestions as to how to respond?
Oh, yes. Yes and no, and I feel your pain. Let me just start by saying that, because it is a difficult conversation when they're just focusing just on HEDIS. But the self-management goal setting would be the one piece that I would suggest. And I tell you, because it's a cost-saving measure within the practice, because you can look, one of the things that is not a specific HEDIS measure, but is one of the things that helps them meet those measures, is the ability to have a faster interaction with a patient that is clearer and cleaner and has more, gets a patient being more activated, or what they used to call compliant. If you can have a conversation with the practice about, we can help you accomplish some of those things that can help you hit your HEDIS numbers, that then can be very helpful. We've had this come up a couple of times with some of the community health centers in Colorado, and it just is a little bit longer conversation in terms of sometimes it takes a while for it to come back around. One of the things that we will be talking about in terms of how you find partners and how you work with partners is how ready are they to have a conversation with you. And it may be that this is a practice that that may not be ready right now, but may be ready later. But I would definitely approach it from the we can help with the communications that can help you reach those measures. And that then involves, and I'll tell you what that comes from, is what we have heard back from practices about how much faster it is to set self-management goals with someone who has been through a program like the Diabetes Prevention Program or one of the chronic disease programs out of Stanford or any of the evidence-based programs. Once you've had some experience with goal setting, it's much easier to set a goal with your healthcare provider. And so time saving would be what I would suggest as a way in.
So almost as if you're helping them streamline their communications, Lindsay?
Helping them streamline their communications and helping them document what they are communicating, and also being able to assist them in some of the, I guess, the patient activation measures that they need to accomplish in order to get the HEDIS numbers. So they need to be having patients successful in the actions they're taking in order to then move through all of the other documentation they're doing. So I would suggest that the time-saving piece would be what I would say in terms of streamlining and in terms of messaging and in terms of helping them get their patients to a more activated station.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Any other questions, guys? Anybody have any other questions or comments or places that you might be stuck in your state trying to work with a local patient-centered medical home?
Well, I want to share with you one of my very favorite stories, which is a practice that we worked with up in the mountains here in Colorado. And it was a practice that had a class in the lobby after hours, and we had the provider was not so sure this was going to be something that would be valuable to him, and we said, we'll try it and refer some of those patients that you're not really sure what else you can do to be helpful with them. So refer those patients and let's see what happens. And so after he had completed his first class and we were back with him and had provided him with some feedback on, you know, who had attended and how often they'd attended, and also some feedback on what the patient had set as their self-management goals, he said, "I have to tell you that the patient came back, and I've been seeing this guy for years, and I almost didn't recognize him because when I walked in the room for the first time ever, he was wearing clean clothes. And he himself was clean, and he was sober. And I talked with him about the class, and we talked about why he was there, and we went through the visit, and it was rather astounding." And so I said, "Well, so would you say that him having completed this class had a big change in the quality of the conversation you and your patient had?" And he said no, which kind of threw me because I wanted him to say yes. And he said, "No, it did not change the quality of our conversation at all." But then he went on and he said, "But for the first time ever, there were two of us in the conversation." So his viewpoint had been he was always talking at the patient and the patient was not hearing him. And now the patient was actually involved in the conversation. And from that standpoint, many things are possible, and that is the power of an evidence-based program, is that those kind of activities, having the individual take some responsibility and practice some of those things, is really what makes it worthwhile. And once that happens for a provider, they become champions. Even one referral or one recommendation at a time, they become champions within their own practice. That's the long-term goal. The short-term goal is to be able to make the initial connection so you have the opportunity to get them to the point that they're hearing that back from their patients. So we will definitely share some more information and some more videos on that work the next time we get together. Did I see somebody's hand up? Or somebody else is waving?
Oh, this is Laura. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I had my hand up, and I thought I'd kind of answered my own question, but I'll go ahead and be brave and ask it anyway. This is Laura from Oregon. Lindsay, thanks so much for a fantastic presentation.
Oh, thank you.
We have an interesting situation in Oregon, and I don't know how many other states are in the boat, but we have kind of a dueling banjos situation going between the patient-centered medical home initiative and a local incentive program that we call patient-centered primary care home, just to make it complicated. And we've done a lot of work really more focused on our state initiative because that seems where the majority of the focusing now. But do you have any insight into how to kind of juggle those relationships, run across that?
I think you said a really good word when you said juggle, because I think they are very different relationships, and it's kind of an interesting, you know, several years ago, it was about finding anyone who was speaking this language. Now it's about how do you juggle all the different players and what language and what version of the language they're speaking. And as you have already sort of alluded to in your question, they have different measurements, and they have different outcomes, and but the basics are still the same in that you have something that they need and that can help them meet what they need to meet. So even understanding, it's not understanding what's going on in Oregon, I know that if you can approach each of those folks that you're juggling and say, what do you need in order to, I understand you have things you need to meet, tell me what you need and how you need it documented, and we can help with that. So you can approach each of them individually and have the same discussion with them. You will probably find that they are closer, although the jargon will be different, that what they are needing from you is a way to track a referral, a way to do a recommendation, materials that they can use as educational tools, and then feedback on who's attending, what happened to the referral, and feedback to the practice on the progress they're making, so that you can work with those pieces in a way that will work for each of those folks that you're juggling. It's very interesting. It's a strange competition that's happening. And so what we thought would be a great selling point sometimes in terms of, oh, I'm working with this health system and this health system, is not so much necessarily a strong selling point, except that it gives more experience with how to have the conversation about, okay, what exactly do you need? Now let's document what we can do and what our expectations are of the partnership. So that would be what I would... I sometimes think it's juggling. Sometimes I think it's that twirling plates thing that they used to do on the Ed Sullivan Show. So
one other thing that I would offer from, at least from our state's perspective, that primary care assistance different across the country, but we've found a wonderful ally in our primary care association because a big piece of their charge is to help their federally qualified health center achieve patient-centered medical homes. And so we went and sold a collaborative, learning collaborative idea to them a few years ago, and they've been on contract with us for years helping us develop just referral systems, working with practice change, and they've been so helpful because they really understand the culture. They know what their motivations are, they know what their challenges are, and they also have that expertise. Being able to provide that really coaching about how do you change or how do you get a referral system in place that are. And so, anyway, I would offer that as a for others.
I would totally agree with you, and there are several different coaching and transformation organizations that are doing work. There's many of them across the country. That's definitely a good one, North American Management. There are a number of different transformation coaching firms across the country that are also doing this work and are great at helping you to connect with specific practices or with a whole health system if you're, you know, doing a larger scale implementation. But that's very good and very helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? We're almost at the time that we need to end the call or the webinar today. And I just wanted to let people know when you do sign off, you'll get a survey from ReadyTalk, and also attached to that survey, I hope anyways, is the homework document. And so if that slide went past you rather fast and you weren't able to write all the things down that you need to do or were asking you to do, you don't need to do anything really. But please take a look at the document that's attached to the survey, and you can download it and print it out as well. And so just to remind everybody, December 3rd at 2 p.m. Eastern Time will be another 90-minute webinar, and the information will go out prior to that, and we'll set up the registration similar to the way we had it now for this webinar. And if you have any questions in the meantime, please feel free to either contact Lindsay or contact myself. And we just wanted to thank everybody for being on the webinar today and for the great information, and hope to have you all back on December 3rd. Thanks, everyone. Thank you, Lindsay.
Thanks, Mary.
Bye. Thank you. Please stand by.